The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Usually, I come and I have some topic that I have in mind to talk about, and it's interesting, I find often whatever topic I bring, it seems to... The Dharma seems to have this character where whatever I talk about, it seems to be able to touch something, perhaps, in each person. And yet, from time to time, I like to actually find out what is out there, what kind of questions you have. So that's what I'd like to do tonight. I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to get some questions from you. So I didn't come with a prepared talk tonight. And the way I'd like to do this is... or my suggestion of how to do this, and we'll see how it goes, is I'd like to pull 6 or 7 questions from you, and I'll write them down, and then I'll try to create a Dharma talk out of those 6 or 7 answers to those 6 or 7 questions. So we'll see how that goes. The questions can be on any topic. It could be on practice. Meditation practice, the sitting practice. It might be on something that's happening in your daily life that you're interested in exploring. How can you bring mindfulness to that? Or it might be a Dharma topic that you've heard, perhaps a word like, I hear this word dukkha a lot. What is that? Or, so whatever is of interest to you, I am open for questions. And at this point, I'll just take the questions, so I'll write them down, and we'll go from there. I'm not sure I'm hearing it through the system. Is the light green on the side?
Now it's on, I believe.
Good, now I hear it.
I think it was a month or two back, you had a talk, and you introduced the analogy of the scooter, where you would kick and glide, mm-hmm. and to try to get us to focus on the here and now in a relaxed manner, and then when we start wobbling, we go to kick again. And so I found that analogy worked really well, and I was also reading Sayadaw Pandita's book, where he talked about I think it's vikara and vitaka. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know if those are the same things, or they seem like they're the same concept, like the kicking and gliding, uh-huh. Or if they're not, uh-huh. I guess you can say no. And then also, how do they relate? Those are jhana factors, mm-hmm. and are those actually... Is it the same as experienced in first jhana?
Okay.
Thank you.
Robert?
So someone asked this question to me, so I'm going to pose it to you. So the question, as it was asked, was in Buddhism, we're taught that, we can verify experience, we can verify whether something is true or not with our own direct experience. So what about this question of rebirth? That seems to be something that has to be taken on faith. So is there a way in our experience to know whether this teaching on rebirth is something that we can understand better.
Okay.
So I heard a song. I came to one of the morning sittings, and you were talking about the middle way, and. I couldn't get it out of my head that I felt like I was stuck in the middle way. And and maybe I'm really off track with that, but I felt like I've been, with my practice of over 25 years, I felt maybe that's where I'm stuck. I'm in the middle. So I want to know if you
I need to hear
that.
A little more about what you mean by stuck.
Stuck in terms of getting to another level.
What does getting to another level mean?
Getting to another level, consciously, subconsciously, and through my practice.
I'm not completely sure I have a sense. I mean, I can talk around this topic and see if it will address.
And maybe that. It would help to hear it again about defining what the middle way is.
Yes, that's how I would approach it.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
I understand there's different forms of Buddhism, depending on what country you go to, and some forms believe in an afterlife. And I've been coming here for a couple of years now, and I love the teachings, but I understand. And where do the Hindus cross over into Buddhism, and where are the similarities, and what form are we practicing here?
Yeah, these are big questions.
Oh.
Maybe not.
I at this point I think of it like the Protestants that are Christians, and there's all the different Protestant sects, and they all have a different way of approaching it. Uh-huh. Is Buddhism similar to that?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Sure.
You don't have to answer if we don't get to it. I've been, like I said, on the practice for many years, and I've dabbled in different, I'm Jewish, but I've dabbled in different religions, and coming here is a very special place, and I think it's a great learning experience for many reasons, but what I've always done is practiced on my own. So coming into a group like this, it's a little, I'm just curious how to get more involved. I mean, there's so many ways, but yet I don't really know how to engage to, learn more about what we're doing, what we're doing here.
Okay. That's a great question. And any last one? Did you have one? Mm-hmm. There's another mic. This will be the last one.
So I'd like your thoughts on when a particularly severe life event is going on for a very long time, how to deal with it.
Okay. I'll give a general response to that. I think the response could be more specific depending on what the situation is, but I'll speak generally to it. Okay, let's see. So I'll start from kind of the 35,000 foot level. What is Buddhism? What are we doing here? there are many different forms of Buddhism. They all roughly come back to. There are teachings that they share, and they all share in particular the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths: the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, which is the middle way, the Eightfold Path, which I'll come to in a moment. The teachings that the Buddha offered, the historical Buddha offered, were really gathered around those explorations, I'll say. because they are explorations. Buddhism, I think of Buddhism more as a set of practices and life tools than a religion, for myself anyway. I especially think of it that way, that these Four Noble Truths in the Pali Canon, which is connected to one of the flavors of Buddhism, the Theravada form of Buddhism, which is the flavor that is primarily practiced here. In the Pali Canon, the Buddha offered that these noble truths, these Four Noble Truths, aren't simply just meant to be believed, but they're actually practices. They're meant to be acted on. So we understand suffering. We turn towards suffering. We explore it in our experience. This relates to that question of, you know, what is true in our experience. So we explore in our experience what suffering is. We explore in our experience how that suffering is caused. So the understand suffering allows us to begin to see what the causes of suffering are. And then the Buddha suggested that we don't just passively sit by with that. We begin to actively find ways to let go of those causes. And from the letting go of those causes of suffering, we begin to experience a release from that suffering. And there are tools that we can cultivate that, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, the middle way, that supports us to understand the suffering, let go of the cause. So there are some tools that are offered. And so those kind of basic teachings are central to all of the different kinds of Buddhism. I don't actually know the history of how Buddhism was created into all the different schools. I mean, I've heard some lectures about it, but it's not in my head to repeat to you. But I think essentially there was, you know, the time of the Buddha that he taught, and then after that time, after he died, he didn't create a leader for his Sangha. He basically, you know, asked everybody to be a lamp unto themselves, to use the teachings as they've understood and to continue practicing. And people began practicing and teaching in their own way. And so it inevitably transformed, you know, the way people explored it, the kind of meditation that they taught. It inevitably transformed. And there's, you know, a few basic schools, I guess we could say, of Buddhism that are alive today. There's the Theravada, which is, the Theravada literally translates as the school of the elders. Thera meaning elder, and this is the school that comes through the teachings that are offered in the Pali Canon, which are the closest record that we have of what the historical Buddha said. So the teachings in the Pali Canon, plus commentaries that were written about those teachings in the several hundred years following the Buddha. So those two pieces together, the Pali Canon plus the commentaries, come together to form the tradition of the elders. So that is kind of one school of Buddhism that has survived from the time of the Buddha. And there were, people that went up into China, and from China, in China, Buddhism became what was called Chan, which is what Zen Buddhism evolved from. So the migration into China, the school of Buddha, the teachings of Buddhism evolved some in China. It became what's called the Mahayana school, which is literally translated as a greater vehicle. The Mahayanists, I don't know a lot about the Mahayana teachings. I know a little bit about some of their meditation practices, and from my understanding, actually, some of their meditation practices are quite similar to some of the ones that we use in the Theravada. And so the meditation technologies aren't that different. They may come at them from some different ways at times. But there are some differences in the Mahayana. I think one of the central differences in the Mahayana school is what they set up as being the pinnacle of the of what we aspire to. So in the Theravada tradition, the pinnacle of what we aspire to is to become fully awakened, to free ourselves from greed, aversion, and delusion, and to become enlightened, free from suffering. The term enlightenment, nirvana, nibbana in Pali, essentially means to become cool, to become released from greed, aversion, and delusion. And so in the Theravada tradition, that's what we're looking for. That's what we're practicing for, I'd say. That's what we're practicing for, is that freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion, which is understood to be, in that second noble truth, the causes of suffering. So those are the causes of suffering. And so as we begin to understand those as causes, which are arising in our own minds, the fact of wanting something to be other than it is, wanting to have something that we don't have, wanting to get rid of something that we do have, we are kind of in conflict with things as they are. And the letting go of that wanting things to be other than they are is the letting go of that greed and aversion. And then the letting go also of delusion, a confusion about what is happening. So that's the kind of aspiration of the Theravada Buddhist. In the Mahayana school, the aspiration is to become, is to be a bodhisattva, which is a being who is dedicated to postponing their own enlightenment, their own liberation, so that they can help all other beings become liberated. So one of the central teachings in the Mahayana practice is compassion. So they bring both compassion and wisdom together, that the compassion is the fuel, essentially, for the practice, that as we see the suffering in the world, our motivation for the practice becomes becoming as knowledgeable, as wise as we can to help other beings, to help other people become free from their suffering. There are several other ways in which the understandings of the mind and what full liberation looks like are different between the Theravada and the Mahayana. I won't go into those kind of doctrinal issues. One name you may sometimes hear in the Mahayana school named the Theravada school Hinayana. So you may hear that term from time to time, Hinayana Buddhism. It's basically an epithet. You know, it's a derogatory term. It means lesser vehicle. So the Mahayanists looked at what the Theravadins were doing, and they're saying, well, they're just trying to get themselves enlightened. We've got the better vehicle. You know, we want to help everybody get enlightened. So they in a way felt like their Buddhism was better than the Theravada Buddhism. Following, I believe that the third form of Buddhism kind of followed from the Mahayana, or was an evolution from the Mahayana, is called Vajrayana, which I think means diamond vehicle. And it's in the Mahayana, it's kind of in the Mahayana kind of terrain. I don't know a lot about that. Again, I've just read a little bit, but for me, actually, what's most important is what are the practices that can help me to become free? And I've found the practices that have been offered here at IMC to be incredibly helpful. I've found benefits in my own life from them. And so it's kind of like I felt like I found home here. And I've learned a little bit about some of the other schools of Buddhism, but I was so at home here that I didn't feel a need to kind of go out and wander around and sample all of the varieties that are around. I mean, there's Zen Buddhism, there's a bunch of different varieties of Mahayana Buddhism practiced in Tibet and India. So there's a lot of them. And you're right, it's kind of similar to, Catholicism and Protestantism. Kind of there's some bigger differences there between Catholicism and Protestantism, you know, that basically I think Catholicism believes that you have to go through the priests to get to God, and the Protestants believe, no, you can pray to God directly, you can contact God directly. So I think in a way the difference between Mahayana and Theravada may have that kind of flavor of a difference, that there's a kind of a big difference in what the underlying, or the kind of the underlying motivations are. And then, you know, there also were a whole bunch of other flavors of Buddhism that have died out. We have texts that were from other kind of Buddhist traditions that they seem to have gotten lost. Maybe there were all these invasions from various other places, and, you know, a lot of the texts got wiped out, a lot of the monks and nuns got killed in these invasions, and so whole schools of Buddhism actually got wiped out. So there were some other ones that we no longer really have access to. Another distinction between Theravada and Mahayana that I'm aware of is that in the Mahayana, I would say that some of the central teachings in the Mahayana, while they do take the texts of the records of what the Buddha said as being very important, they also have some other texts that are central, and these I would call revealed teachings. These are teachings where somebody like went off to a cave and meditated, and in that meditation they had a vision of the Buddha, or a big snake came out of the ground and brought a text to them and said, this is a teaching, and so they, through a meditative process, understood some wisdom, and then that text then, that what they had revealed to them, have become very central in the Mahayana teaching. There's some famous suttas like the Lotus Sutra. You might have heard of the Lotus Sutra. That's what I would call a revealed teaching. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Again, a kind of a revealed teaching. So those teachings are very central to the Mahayana school. There were a lot of forms of religion in India at the time of the Buddha, and I don't think actually Hinduism was in. I think it was evolving right around the same time as the Buddha. I don't know that for sure, but I don't think Hinduism per se was in there. There were the Jains were there, and again, I don't know all the different beliefs that they had. The Buddhism is kind of notably different from other religions in India at the time, in that it doesn't. There is a kind of an understanding that there are deities, but they are not central to your liberation. They're just like any other being. That's the way it is in Theravada Buddhism, at least. In Hinduism, I know they do have several gods. They've got Vishnu and I can't remember them all. There are three main gods, the creator, the destroyer, Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. There they are. So there are gods in the Hindu, and that's a way that Buddhism really differs, I think, from many religions, is that it's not particularly about gods or worshiping gods. It's about looking at your own heart and mind and seeing how is suffering created and freeing yourself from that suffering, freeing yourself from the patterns in your mind that take you in that direction. So what the Buddha really offered was a technology for unraveling suffering, and it didn't particularly need or depend on any kind of external savior. So the Buddha is not a god. He's not considered to be a god in our tradition. I don't think in any of the Buddhist traditions the Buddha is elevated to the status of a god. So it was always understood that he was a human being. Let's see. I think that's probably enough for that question. So to come back to the kind of the basic teachings of what we explore here, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, sometimes the Buddha's teaching is called the middle way. This is... there were a couple of different ways that it was understood. One of the ways that this middle way was understood was that it was a middle way between kind of different things that were popular at the time, popular religious forms for freeing oneself. There were the annihilationists let me back up. There were people who believed that the kind of the way towards freedom was to deprive yourself of as much sense pleasure as possible. Starve yourself, make yourself really uncomfortable, essentially really abuse the body. There were people that believed, you can indulge yourself in the sense pleasures, and happiness will come through finding the deepest, the most pleasant experiences possible. And the most pleasant experiences possible being in the form of deep, deep states of concentration. So the Buddha looked at that, and he actually explored, in his own path, he explored both sides of that. First of all, he had lived in a situation in the place where he grew up. He had it pretty good. His father was a kind of a local, not exactly a king, but probably the head of kind of an estate. And they had several palaces, one in the hills for when it was hot, and they had beautiful gardens. And he describes his life before he decided to leave home as being very pleasant. And he had nothing wanting. He always had good food, beautiful things to look at, lovely music to entertain him. He didn't have anything that he wanted in the realm of sense pleasure. And he found, well, it's great, but it goes away. I see people get old, I see people get sick, people die, it's like the sense pleasure doesn't really do it ultimately. So is there something else? Is there some other way to find happiness? And so he went in search of that. And at the time of the Buddha, there were a number of traditions, kind of as I mentioned earlier, a number of people exploring these questions of where is happiness. And so he decided to leave home and to explore this question for himself. And he went to some of the leading teachers of his day. And he went to some of the first teachers that he met, taught these very deep, refined states of concentration. The mind gets very, very still, quiet, very blissful, refined states of concentration. And he discovered as he practiced those, got very facile with those, very able to attain those states at will, that when he came out of them, it was like nothing had really changed. There was simply, there was still the suffering. There was still aging, sickness, and death. There was still pain. There was still sorrow, grief, despair. So it's like, well, this isn't really doing it either. So that's kind of that side of the pleasure, looking at the pleasure. And then he decided to go off to do the ascetic practices. There were other sadhus at the time who were exploring very strong ascetic practices. And there's one sutta in which the Buddha described the kinds of practices he did. And he described them all as being extremely painful. I think some of the notion was that if you created enough pain in the body, the soul would eject itself from the body somehow, and you would achieve some kind of transcendent realization. That's my understanding. So he began starving himself. He explored all these very grueling ascetic practices, never lying down. He got down at one point to eating one grain of rice a day. He described his body as being so emaciated that when he touched his belly, he could feel his backbone. So he explored that side, and again, he was just about on the point of death when he realized, you know, this isn't answering my question either. You know, this does not feel like the way either. And so he took some nourishment, regained his health, and began to explore, is there something different? And he essentially found for himself there's something between these sides of pleasure, of kind of indulging in pleasure and avoidance that we can practice. You know, it's neither grasping for pleasure or pushing away the unpleasant, or clinging to the unpleasant is what the ascetic practices were essentially holding to those. Instead, to just meet experience as it is. So this is one way to look at the middle way, that it's a middle way between when experience arises, it's a middle way between clinging to pleasant, getting rid of unpleasant. Instead, just noticing, this is what's happening. Pleasant experiences arising. Unpleasant experiences arising. That's one way to look at the middle way. It's the middle way between kind of pleasure and pain. The way that we normally react to pleasure and pain. Another way that the middle way is understood between these notions of there was kind of notions at the time of the Buddha also of when we die. I mean, this touches on the rebirth question a little bit. What happens when we die? Is there something that continues beyond, is there a soul that continues? Or is there nothing? When we die, is it just, that's it? So this is kind of the eternalists versus the annihilationists. And there were people at the time of the Buddha that had both of these views. And his enlightenment, the understanding that came at the time of his enlightenment, what he understood was that neither one of them is actually true. That they both are founded on, in his understanding, they're both founded on a misunderstanding that there is actually something here, an abiding entity here. Now, that there is perhaps a soul that continues is a kind of an imputing, an abiding entity. It's imputing something that will continue. The other side of something that ends, you know, that one too is kind of believing that there's something here now that's going to end. And he said it's neither one of those. There is something that's here, but it's not a thing. There's something, he wouldn't call it a soul or a self. He would call it a process. That there is an arising, there's a series of arising conditions that creates action and feeling and perception and thinking. And we are just this flow of process. And so he said that his teaching is a middle way between these two, and the way he put it was something like, for one who sees experience coming into being, so there is that experience comes into being. We all experience things coming into being. When one experiences something coming into being, the idea that things don't exist doesn't occur to one. And when one sees things falling apart, and we do see things kind of falling apart at times, you know, we notice that things are impermanent. When we connect to that side of the equation, the notion of something lasting and being permanent doesn't occur to us. And he says, so my understanding is that there is just this process of causes and conditions creating a flow. There is no thing here. There is a series of things coming together and falling apart, coming together, falling apart, coming together, falling apart. So he called that the middle teaching. So that's distinct in terms of what we might call the middle path, which are the set of practices that we engage in to understand what the Buddha taught. So the middle path being, you know, this middle way between, the reason it being called the middle is for those two things are two of the reasons I understand it, why it is called the middle path. The actual, within the Buddha's Fourth Noble Truth, he calls it the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path being a set of practices, essentially, that offer us a way to explore our experience, both so that we aren't attaching to the pleasant and getting rid of the unpleasant, and so that we begin to understand our experience in terms of this process, that we begin to see our experience as a process rather than as a me going through doing things, rather than me being a self. Now that whole question of not self, that's a huge topic. I won't go into that at this point. But it just that these practices that are offered in the Eightfold Path begin to help us to understand both of those areas, the teaching on not self and this understanding of how our reactivity comes to be, how our suffering is created out of our reacting to what is pleasant, what is unpleasant. So that middle path offers, first of all, a reorientation of what is it that causes our suffering? We normally think of our suffering, you know, in our cultural indoctrination. Our suffering comes because there's things out there happening and they're doing the things out there, the people out there are causing our suffering. And that we're, you know, there's something out there that is a problem. And it's the thing out there that's a problem. That's our kind of, that's our way of relating to things, is that there's things out there that are problems. Either there's it's a problem because it's something we need or want and we don't have it, or it's a problem because it's something that we want to get rid of that's unpleasant and we have it. So we have this orientation to the world, is the problem's out there. I'm a fine. There's no problem with me. It's just out there. If I can only arrange the world out there to be the way I'd like it to be, then that would be good. What the Buddha pointed to in this reorientation is that what he understood when he explored his own mind is that it's not what's happening out there that causes our suffering. There is something happening out there, and then there is a response in our mind. There's a response in our experience. We like certain things. We don't like other things. We want to have certain things. We want to get rid of other things. So that process of liking, of not liking, of greed, of aversion, is happening in our minds. And that process, that very process, it's framed in the Second Noble Truth as craving. That as soon as we want something to be other than it is, as soon as that feeling of wanting springs up in us, there is an immediate feeling that something's wrong. It's the wanting itself that creates that feeling that something is wrong. So it is something in our own minds that is creating the sense that something is wrong. There's nothing out there that is inherently wrong. It is our own response to it that creates the feeling that something is wrong. And so the Buddha saw that, and he pointed to that. He said, that is something that we should look at. We should look at that wanting. So the Eightfold Path is essentially a set of tools, a set of practices designed to help us to understand that wanting. To understand that wanting as being something that is a doing in our own mind. It's a good news, actually, that it's something that it's doing in our own minds, because if it actually were something out there that was causing all of our suffering, it would be hopeless. We would not be able to free ourselves from suffering. It is because it is something happening in our own minds that we have this possibility of freeing ourselves from suffering. We have the possibility of recognizing that craving is this kind of base sense of that dissatisfaction comes because the wanting is there. When the wanting goes away, the feeling of dissatisfaction that things are wrong goes away. So that's the kind of reorientation that the Buddha proposed, and his Eightfold Path is essentially a set of tools that allows us to explore that question. In terms of being stuck in it, there are many, many ways we can get stuck. We usually get stuck because we're not seeing some way in which we are holding on to something. We're not seeing some belief that we have that something is necessary or important. We're assuming it's necessary, and we're not seeing it as a belief. So often it's kind of like where we get stuck is when we're seeing our experience through a particular view, a particular filter, a particular set of ideas, and we don't know we're seeing it through that set of ideas. So we're going along, and it's like, well, you know, it's like those set of ideas are so deeply embedded in our psyche that we don't recognize them. It's kind of like we're a fish swimming in water, and we don't recognize the water we're swimming in because it's so familiar to us. And so there's ideas, views, beliefs that we hold that are like that. And it takes some willingness to keep looking back. And the kind of, for me, it's like the trust in the Buddha's teaching of if there's suffering, there's clinging. If there's suffering, there's something I'm holding on to here. There's some belief operating. So if there is suffering, to begin to explore, okay, what is that belief? What's behind this? So when we get stuck, I find it's often in that terrain where there's some belief that we're just not really seeing. And there were, you know, some main beliefs that the Buddha pointed to that we all share as human beings that we get stuck in. The three of the main ones that we take what is impermanent to be permanent. And we take what is unreliable as something that is unreliable as a source for lasting happiness as being reliable. And we take what is not self, what is ephemeral, what is a changing flow of process, to be a static thing. And so those are kind of views that we put on reality that we all get stuck in. So it's a long process, this process of exploring our minds and freeing ourselves from this craving, this wanting. This Eightfold Path that the Buddha described, it's not something that, you know, we read, we hear about, and then suddenly everything's okay. It is a set of practices, and the Buddha talked about his teachings as being a gradual training. That it's not necessarily an instantaneous process. There's just sometimes this question, and this question of, well, is enlightenment a gradual process, or does it happen in an instant? And I read the other day a beautiful way of expressing it, and it's like, well, it's gradual until it happens instantaneously. That we basically use the practices of the Eightfold Path to begin to put our, you know, we begin to understand things in a different way, and then we can begin to see experience more clearly We see, we understand our experience in terms of suffering, the cause of suffering, letting go of suffering. And as we begin to see our experience in those terms, we begin to recognize those moments of release, those moments when wanting disappears, and we feel when that wanting disappears, that sense of things aren't right, when that sense of wanting disappears, we get that sense of release. We get that sense of what that third noble truth is. We get a little taste of that freedom. So it is a gradual path. And sometimes it, you know, the path feels like, you know, we learn things and we find that there's a sense of growth and change, and then it feels like we hit a plateau. And you know, it just sometimes we just feel like we're on a plateau. And you know, there's another analogy that I like to offer. I know I've offered it in this class at times. The Buddha talked about the path being like, if there's a shipwreck and all the parts of the ship are strewn around the beach, there may be rope and wood and et cetera, you know, all these different parts of the ship. The sun, the sand, the wind, the waves, the water are going to wear down those parts. And day to day, you're not going to see much change in those parts. You know, so a little grain of sand hits that rope, a little bit of wind hits that rope. It doesn't look like anything's happening. But over time, there is a change. And, you know, 6 months, a year passes, and you go back and you try to pick up that rope, and it falls apart in your hands. And so even though it may not seem like anything's happening, it may feel like there's a sense of staticness or not shifting. I remember that rope analogy. It's like, you know, day to day, it may not look like there's a change happening, but bringing mindful attention to what's happening, as Gil sometimes says, no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. You know, it does transform us. It may not be apparent to us how it's transforming us in a moment. Well, I am not going to get to all of these questions. Well, I'll save some of them for when I get back, I guess. Why don't I stop there and see if there's any questions about what I've said? And we'll, was there somebody that... No? Okay. Okay, well, I'll pick another question then. Let's see. So I think I'll talk about the scooter analogy. I don't think I'll get to be able to make a complete answer to that question in this moment. But it kind of relates to this gradual unfolding, in a way, of the practice. And how we can just keep going. So the analogy that I've talked about is, it's an analogy for how we bring our attention to experience, that as we're practicing mindfulness, sometimes we turn our attention to our experience and you know, it's kind of like, okay, I'm sitting in meditation and I'm going to be present for the whole 45 minutes or whatever, you know, I'm going to sit down and it's like we pick up the entire 45 minute sitting in the first second of the sitting, and we try to make the effort in that moment to be mindful for the whole time. It's kind of like, okay, I'm going to do this. That kind of effort isn't particularly effective for meditation practice. It's more effective to just do a little bit for a moment. Make just enough effort to connect with like a half a breath. Just enough effort to connect with a half a breath. And then do it again. At the, connect with an in-breath, and then so just enough effort to connect with an in-breath, and then at the end of that in-breath, enough effort to connect with an out-breath. So that it's a very small amount of effort done many times. And in that way, there's a kind of a little bit of a momentum that builds. So I've used this analogy of a scooter, you know, that the scooters that those kids ride. Initially, when you're at a standstill, you have to tap the ground to get the momentum going. And you have to tap kind of frequently to get that scooter going. And so that's kind of like the initial just enough effort. I mean, it's like if you tried to bear down to get that scooter going and like push really hard, well, you could go for a little ways with that. But, you know, it's not going to take you that far. Whereas if you kind of just tap, 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 tap frequently, it gets you rolling. It gets the momentum going. And then you can ride for a while. So likewise with the meditation, the effort, the amount of effort that we make can be very light, just a little bit, just enough effort to stay connected with the in-breath. And then you get a sense of, over time, how... you begin to get familiar, like on the scooter, you get familiar with what it feels like when you start to wobble. You know, it's like you know you're starting to wobble, so you need to put your foot down and tap again to have the momentum continue. So in meditation, we get to this place where we use enough effort to be with an in-breath and then with an out-breath and then with an in-breath and then with an out-breath. And after some time, we don't have to try as hard. It's like we can ride for a while. We can ride the waves of the breath without having to remind ourselves, okay, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. After a while, we get kind of this momentum going, and we can just hang out with the breath. And then we start to get familiar with what it feels like for the mind to get wobbly. You know, we start to get familiar with what it feels like. My own experience of it is like the attention connected with an experience of breathing, I get familiar with what it feels like for that attention to kind of lose touch a little bit with that. And it begins to kind of drift off into thought. It pulls away a little bit. And when that begins to happen, it's like, oh, add a little bit of effort, add a little bit of energy. In-breath. Connect with an in-breath. Connect with an out-breath. And then we begin to get a sense of how much effort do we need to make in this moment? So it's an exploration. It's kind of an art form in a way. It's kind of the art of meditation, learning how to apply our effort. How much effort do we need to make in this moment? That's sometimes a question I ask myself. How little effort do I need to be present right now? That tends to support me to stay present in a relaxed way. I think a lot of us can be over-efforters. We tend to do a little too much. And so this short moments many times helps to smooth out the effort. And it's time to end, so I'll just say one piece, and that is you asked about these qualities of vitaka vichara. They are what are sometimes translated as applied thought and sustained thought. And they would relate directly to, you know, the moment, the two kinds of ways I described the meditation is like making that effort of connect with the breath, a moment of connecting with the breath, connect with an in-breath, connect with an out-breath. That would be the applied kind of practice, applying your attention to that experience. The vichara, the sustained attention, is like that riding that scooter. You know, it's the recognition of there is energy going here. There's already this flow of energy going, and I can ride that. And we get familiar with how that energy, that vichara, feels, and we learn how those two qualities of vitaka vichara, of applied and sustained energy, relate to our practice. So it's identical. Those are identical, and those are just. Quickly, those are the jhanic factors, and it's the strength of how clear they are that makes them jhanic factors. So I'm sorry I didn't get to all the questions. I hope this was useful for you. Thank you.